First, I'd like to thank the organizers for the chance to talk here with this great institute and with great people. And also, I had another reason to thank for the organizers because all of them helped me to explain something I don't have to explain now. So, what I'd like to do. To explain today is look at the G action on a compact manifold. G is a compact D group, and we look at the quotient space in both commutative and the non-commutative ways, and I want to end up with the local index formula for transversely elliptic operators on them. So basically, I'll try to do three basic things. One is to introduce this algebra A. I'm going to say which is the non-commutative version of the quotient space. And another thing is I will introduce the transversely elliptic operators and the index by ITI. And then I'll discuss local index formulas and even some a little bit geometry on that. This is the first time I talk. My talk started with G manifold because I believe it helps to just look at the G manifold in a new way. Let's just review some very basic facts. I'm sure many of you are familiar with, but I need it anyway. So, G in my talk is always a compact D group, and G points are homogeneous spaces. We look at closed subgroup of G. And this is just one orbit, but now we look at as a quotient. We look them as points. And G and I would use G parentheses for conjugacy classes of the closed subgroups, and I will use the language orbit type, which is decided by H bracket, but or G mod H, but I'm going to use later for you for this talk. And if you look at just the G points, there are only one, basically just one equivalent, G equivalent map between G points. You can only have surjection from one to the other. So you have to go from the quotient group, the first quotient group has to be smaller as in the conjugacy class. So this gives a partial order among the orbit types. Okay, next, I will just say a little bit about the good G spaces, which I'm. There are a lot of G spaces are called GCW complexes, which I'm going to describe in the following. In particular, there's a theorem by Edelman in 1983 that says G manifolds are all GCW complexes, and he showed this by first defining one in one sense in the G simplicial complexes, and then show that G simplicial complexes are GCW complexes in the following sense. It's just like a regular GCW complexes. I'm just going to tell you what are the cells and what are the attaching maps. And cells are basically disks and attached with the type, with the orbit type, with the point. It's quotient. Cells are supposed to be quotient. That there are different ways to view these cells. I mean, there are different ways to define the GCW complexes, but we choose this one. And attaching maps are equivalent maps, so we take the boundary of the DN, and which is a sphere, and then we attach it to X. We require that this attaching map is a G equivalent, but this since it's a G equivalent, it's a very simple exercise. You know, you see that it can be reduced to the sphere attached to the 6-point sets of the X. So this gives a picture of, together with this definition, together with the Inman's description, the theorem, it gives a good picture of what G manifolds are like. You can build up with cells like this, and this N is now called the dimension of the cell, because we're looking at it transversely. So you can attach higher dimensional cells to lower dimensional cells, but also the type has to fit, because if you attach something like a type K or G mod K, it has to be a bigger type in the sense that the group is smaller. So bigger type, it should be smaller than the normalizer of the underlying spaces. So this is a rule. So you can just imagine how you can build up G spaces this way. And this this approach actually helps to explain, just roughly explain G equivalent theory, the common G equivalent series. And we put together all the cells with the same orbit, with the same type. So not necessarily now cells, and we can first, for each subgroup, for each closed subgroup H, we find the fixed point set of M for a G manifold. Of course, since my group is compact, if there are only finite many such types, because for a lot of other H, for all of the other H's, this is empty set. And then we find how higher cells attach cells with, in a generalized way, the cells with bigger orbit types, how these attach to the smaller orbits. And all we need to now to check is we just have to find this normalizer action on MH, so by just simple argument. So attaching map has to be a subgroup of up to a conjugate subgroup of normalizer. In other words, you just have in some sense, when you build up a G space from one type to another type, you the problem is reduced to just a smaller group action on a smaller manifold. So that's the basic idea of viewing the G space this way. Okay, now let me just review something about the G equivalent cohomology. I'm not going to define them, but just mention the ones what I mean by them. Okay, G equivalent cohomology, for example, is defined the earliest I know is by Borel. We take a classifying space for G principal bundles and take this equivalent product and we say this cohomology the cohomology is the equivalent cohomology of M, because it recovers, for example, you're free when your action is free, it exactly recovers the quotient, the cohomology of the quotient space, among other properties. And then, but this is too big. And another, now we look at the Henri Cardan introduced the equivalent to the Derham differential forms, which she already talked here. Basically, you take the weight algebra and tensor with all differential forms on M, and we look at the invariant forms, and we call these forms G equivalent Derham forms, for example, differential forms. And Henri Cardan showed that this, once we define the exterior derivative, you will get exactly the same cohomology as the first one, in a special case when G action is locally free. In terms of orbit types, it's just for large orbits. So if your G manifold only has large orbits close to the top, then it's basically quite like the free case. And of course this only recovered the locally free case. Later on, Bloch and Getzler globalized. And now they're calling the Henri Cardan version the local equivalent Derham differential forms. And they showed that if you globalize it, basically the way to globalize it is you look at subgroups H, and you look at the invariant subs, subspace fixed by H, and then look at the normalized action on that, and we just roughly speaking what I described. But of course you don't have to do all the H, you just have to do the groups generated by one element. So this showed that essentially you got the periodic cyclic cohomology of the smooth cross product algebra, which I'm going to define, we call the definition later. And also it gives you the correct version of a G equivalent cohomology, essentially because I don't really understand the full strength of the theorem, because there is we got we put everything in sheaf version and so on. I'm not going to. So the point is, if you just look at G spaces, look at the structures. One way you recovered, you found this algebra A. Okay, now I'm going to go to the main topic, the transversely elliptic operators. So, because I'm going to use some language of G equivalent, orbit types, something like that. For I'm always talking about compact degroup action on compact manifolds, and sometimes just to simplify the argument, I'm going to put more assumptions like orientation preserving action, action by isometry, but they are not so essential. So we're looking at the G invariant pseudo differential operator, or just differential operators on some Hermitian bundle on M, and we look at the directions on each manifold. There's orbit direction, and we look at the transverse direction to the orbit. And this transverse is well defined on the cotangent cotangent bundle. So this is a subspace, and it's not necessarily a sub the subset. I mean, not necessarily a bundle or something, depending on the G action. No. I'm just as just general. Because locally free actually means there's no such directions. So any operator will be. I'm sorry. Locally, no. I said the exactly the wrong direction. So locally free, it's like the looking operators on the transverse direction. Okay, for such operator to be called transversely elliptic means. I have to assume we know something about symbols. This symbol is invertible one sees in the transverse direction. So you see a lot of operators become non-elliptic operators become transversely elliptic in some sense. For example, starting from the easiest, or elliptic operators, of course, are transversely elliptic. But if you look at G points, which basically G mod H, the homogeneous space, M is, and then the whole thing is the orbit, so there are no transverse directions. So any operator, of course, I mean pseudo differential or differential orbit, transversely elliptic, and in some sense I try to explain these operators are now like compact operators if we viewed it in some in the equivalent sense. Okay, so locally it's just like if you look at like a small block just locally, a disk. And the orbit type G mod H, if you have a elliptic orbiter on this disk, if pulled back on the total space, you get a transversely elliptic operator. And then you look at wave operators for you, which is non-elliptic. But it will be elliptic if you, I'm looking at a torus. If it's elliptic, if relative to an action like anything but the diagonal. So this kind of action or whatever, the only bad thing is this action. That's one action. Okay, so, and of course, if you look at the sum, you can say that square root of such things, like it's gamma matrix, another gamma matrix, and gamma 2. For example, if I put an I, and you get this, some kind of square root of wave operators, and they are transversely elliptic. For the same condition, if there are now directions for the metric, as long as your action goes, your transverse direction has no intersection with the now directions, it's a transversely elliptic operator. Okay. Okay. So let me just briefly summarize what we know. Since Atiyah first introduced them, Of course, if look at kernel and co-kernel of P, co-kernel of P actually it's not so good. It's hard to understand that. But I should have said kernel of P star, the origin. In general, you don't get infinitely dimension, or you don't get finite dimensional kernels or something. It's easy to give an example because you take a bundle and map it to zero bundle and take the zero operator, and that'll give you an operator with no zero, and, you know, very big kernel, if you exchange direction, you get another example. Or just put anything on the end, you will get the other kind of example. But these kind of operators are, any operator on a homogeneous space are somewhat, we view them as small operators. Because if you look at the kernel, for example, you count the multiplicity of each irreducible representation, and you get a finite number, each one. And same thing with the kernel of P star. And that's not even the strongest thing we can say, because if you add them, if you take character in the general sense, because I have to define generator, character in a sense, you can sum these, and you can have good control on the operators. So if I take both characters and take the difference, now this is a central distribution on G, and the order of the distribution is controlled by the dimension of the base manifold M. The precise definition of the index is, I will take a test function G, F on the Lie group G, and then I will look at the action of F. Whenever you have an action on the manifold, it induces the action of the smooth functions on, and then compose it with the projections on both null spaces, kernel spaces, and we'll be able to show that these are trace class operators. Atiya showed in a very indirect way, but he even mentioned you can use wavefront set argument to just show it directly, because wavefront set is an argument just to show that an operator is a smoothing or not. So this trace class operators. And Atiya also gave the index theorem for torus actions with finite isotropies. So it's again the bigger orbit types. And he in his argument, he developed the equivalent K theory, just like the Atiya, first Arnold's paper by Atiya Singer. But mm-hmm. Right. And the operator is elliptic transverse indices.
So, for instance, take the zero operator.
Yes, yes. Yeah, but I have to take a finite dimensional bundle over M. For example, M is G mod H. And this is a finite dimensional bundle on M. So, the operator is it's a bounded operator, so it can be extended to L2 to let's say zero. So the kernel space is the whole L2. But since let's just look at the case when M is G. All the L2 functions on the Peter Weil theorem, you can decompose this infinite dimensional space into sums of irreducible representations, and each one has a finite multiplicity, and which is basically the dimension of the. So in a sense, look at the finite dimensional analog. you see, I have a smooth function here. If you smooth functions, you can be decomposed as copies of irreducible representation, but in a very good, very, very controlled way. It's fast decaying, you know, something like that. So you I hope that helps why you get a tree, you know, something summable, because you add up things which are very, you know, controlled, like for example, let's just look at S1, which is a group and this manifold, and I just look at one dimensional bundle on it. And then my kernel is you can decompose the kernel, the whole space, into one dimensional irreducible representations. And if you take a smooth function and you take its Fourier series, it's fast decaying. So you get a trace class operator, and you take the trace. F is a smooth function on the group, G. Okay, so somehow it's hard to get a general index theory, actually we don't have a very general version of index theory. You know, this is just we spend time just to define the index. Berlin Wern in 1997 was the published the first general index theorem for transverse elliptic operators. But then you see, if you look at that paper, you have to develop a version of equivariant like Derham cohomology, and which is basically very similar to the Gatzler block version. You know, they are not exactly the same, but very similar. Same idea. Okay, so we can look at this way with operator algebra approach. Look at these operators. Look at the non-commutative space, which is the smooth cross product. And I'm sure many of you already know. It's just let me just recall the definition. It's a convolution-like product, and in one sense, generalize the point-wise multiplication. In the other extreme, generalized the convolution, and then you can easily see there's a natural action of elements in the algebra A on bundles. For example, L2 bundles, you know, or smooth sections of the bundles. Sections of bundles from L2. Sections or smooth sections, you know, by some kind of extension of the action of G on the bundles. By the way, I forgot to say these bundles are G equivalent. We assume there's action there already, because you know the operator is assumed to be G invariant. I forgot to say that because by the way, not any operator, invariant operators, zero is invariant. Okay, so and then we can give a version of a generalized parametric easily. If there exists a kind of parametrics, you cannot get compact operators, but you, if you compose with the action of smooth functions. Oh, in this case, actually, you know, if you take you can generalize this to continuous functions. And then we look at this, construct a pre-Fred Hoym module. I mean, exactly like, you know, what we do with classical Fred Hoym module theory. And then we can write the RTS index in terms of constant Chern character this way. This is a longer version. You can write it with F, and this Fred Hoym module is a finitely summable. You can use dimension m, dimension of the manifold plus one, just anything bigger than dimension of the manifold. So you can, the index can be expressed as a constant Chern character. But of course, you know, as explained earlier, you know, this is not a way to compute the index. And by the way, Juk was probably the first to point out that TEOs gave cycles in KK. Yeah, actually, here you can use the continuous version, not the smooth version, in the A, the C star algebra. Next, what I'm going to say next is we'll show that actually for Dirac-like operators, you can get the index is the Kalman-Moskowitz local index theorem actually gives is computable, so it, in a sense, it gives you the index theory, and the right hand side, of course, is the cyclic periodic cyclic cohomology on A, so the Chern characters. Okay, so I will say in which case we get a spectral triple. A and H as above, and D has to be somewhat special. G invariant, we have to take a first order differential operator. First order differential operator, symmetric and transversely elliptic, not necessarily elliptic. And then it's if it's symmetric, Kordikov showed in 1991 that it's actually essentially self-adjoint, and so we have a if D is also has scalar symbol, then we have then this AHD is a regular spectral triple. There are many examples, like if D is like this. For example, I just mentioned the pseudo-Riemannian Dirac operator and some kind of parabolic operators. And just there are lots of examples when D squared is a scalar, it has scalar symbol. By symbol, here I mean principal symbol. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is to let's try to put this into a common scourge formula, see what can you get anything and what kind of information you get. Okay, let's recall in common scourge formula you have we take traces of operators like this, and then we take some residue, and the operators of this time multiplied with complex powers of the absolute value inverse. And then I have to look at what kind of these operators are these ones. So I would just first look at these operators, just without the d absolute value inverse. The only trouble with d absolute value inverse, with some complex power, the only trouble it gives is, if I look at these operators, I will get, from classical pseudo differential operators, I'll still get classical pseudo differential operators. But this is only possible exception. So I will call this, I will look at a bigger algebra where these operators lie, and it's much bigger than the algebra these kind of operators generated. But for today, I'm just going to show what can we get from this general information. So I didn't use the fact that we actually don't have to compute a lot of other operators in this algebra, which I'm going to call cross product for some reason, but I'm not trying to define it here. But it's for those of you who know, and I think Sasha talked about it too. And it's a natural thing. It's just look at functions on G, smooth functions on G, and which takes values in pseudo differential operators. But only you don't multiply them pointwisely, and you multiply them in a way that just like how my algebra A is defined. So you show that. So I have definition in the end, but I think I'll just say some kind of algebra because I cannot show the details of the work now. And it turns out, okay, one obvious thing is these operators are no longer pseudo-differential. Because pseudo-differential operators, if you look at the one thing is they have this property called pseudo-local. And these operators can be usually not pseudo-local. And one way to say one way to say an operator is pseudo-local is by the wavefront set. The wavefront set relation is on the diagonal. So this is a stronger version of pseudo-local condition. But then if you look at these kind of operators, look at the elements rho f. And they are kind of moving singular supports around, so they are not pseudo-local. Nonetheless, we know quite well about these operators. We know their wavefront relation in a very special pattern. You can act as showed here and. It's computed by computed in the 80s, and I just digged out this result. let me first there's a problem even to say okay what this means, trace of such an operator in the bigger algebra, I mean, and the d to the minus s. Is this trace class or something for s of high enough power, or high enough order. Okay, because while you look at the Euro case, when we have an elliptic operator, this thing is defined and we have, you know, by Singer's earlier work, and we know pretty well about operators, spectral behaviors about operators like this, and this is something with good control. So that's why we can talk about things like this. But what if my D is like zero? So I have to make sense of this, and the way to make sense of it is found in the TRC original argument. You add some operator to it, positive. In the way I wrote it, you write add two positive operators, basically on the tangential direction. And that'll make this whole thing elliptic, so you can do exactly. So you don't have to, for example, to introduce complex powers for transversely elliptic operators, and which many people tried and actually found something. So, and then second, these are operators are so small that they won't matter. They still make a contribution here, but it won't make any contribution once I take residues and of S at some point. So this is basically, this is just a rough idea, because to show the details I have to, the setting is not correct, but this shows the idea. How we make sense of traces like this by and the K1, K2 are small in the sense that you when you compose with rho f, you compute these wavefront set and you see a small thing. Okay, so this is the first thing, is you use the wavefront set argument just to make sense of we would have in an elliptic case. For example, P is zero. In a special case, P is zero. We add something very big, anything small, in the transfer, if my zero can be a pseudo zero can be transversely elliptic. Okay, then next, how do we compute, once we make sense of this kind of thing, for A is different than pseudo differential operators, something larger than that. And we look at this, and fortunately, Grube and Cili in 1995 already studied operators like this, except, of course, they studied differential operators, pseudo differential operators, not the general class. But basically, you just have to repeat the argument, because this is just a family of, this is a function on G taking values here. So they gave a detailed analysis of, for example, D squared, operators like this. This is in general pseudo differential operator, and D squared is kind of Dirac operator. So I can put my modified D here, adding, if it's not elliptic, adding something here. And then by some kind of integration, by transformation, integral transformation, the asymptotic behavior when lambda goes to infinity, lambda absolute value. By the way, here I'm only using negative numbers, so lambda minus lambda goes to infinity. So by the asymptotic behavior of these resolvent, we got equivalent information for the traces of for the trace of a D inverse, you know, the what commas could use directly. And if we look at these traces, we end up with the integrals like this and oscillating integrals. And the new thing is the e to the I mu. Mu is this, you know, by some mu is like a lambda. Lambda goes to infinity. Behaviors like this, so it's so normally we would use try to use stationary phase argument, but these functions are not so nice. You know, we cannot expect Morse functions or something. But then, if you look at the classical case, this is exactly zero here, so you get one. So in a classical case, you just got this mu inverse, and this is an integral inside. So in a classical sense, I mean, when there's no G action for the elliptic operator, and what we got is just mu to some power and multiplied by number. This basically explained why in a classical case you got simple poles for the zeta function. Here you could get multiple poles. Again, so once we put the trace formula into this general way, you know, I cannot really compute it, but we can estimate. We can estimate how bad this kind of oscillating integrals is, and or into this integrals are. So let's look at for this we use a classical result. So if the idea is this, you try functions like this, you know, normally you will have like functions of x squared, like x squared mu I e dx, something like a function, and look at these polynomial functions, and then you for these polynomial functions you can expand them easily, and by a general argument, and which is called the resolution of singularity, you can reduce general functions to polynomial functions. And of course, we have to ask that this phi is analytic, this is possible by another theorem of Edelman, and in 95, he showed that this generalized Hilbert seventh problem. If you have a Lie group action on a manifold, effectively, then this manifold has a real analytic structure, and this action can be made is real analytic under this real structure. And then we can expand these things in terms of tau, with some log terms and some fraction powers of tau. And I won't have time to explain this, but it's really just working with polynomials. And then you will see the idea and then approximate other things. And then another fact is that the coefficients are all distributions with support inside the set where the phase is stationary, phase function is stationary. So if you are, for example, if your phase function is nice like x, or Morse function, you just have finite many points. Here, you really can get submanifolds or something. But what I'm quoting this theorem is very general, because if you have a specific problem, you should try to find a explicit result. This is a very general argument. Okay, so if when you're putting together all these facts, you let me tell you the conclusion we got for these spectral triples. First, it has a dimension spectrum in Q, discrete with the fractional steps, compared to the regular spectral triples, in you know which are all you know dimensions spread always at the integer points, starting with the highest dimension of the GCW complex, the transverse direction, the disk, the dimension of the disk, and okay, so I didn't say it here, so you have poles starting with some dimension, but then there could be multiple poles. Let me use this to denote. So you have multiple poles, but you can recall that in Kalman's Kitch formula. I'm not going to recall the formula. All I need is that you really need to compute these tau functionals, which are priori are depending on this operator D. In the elliptic case, we show that it's actually not independent of D, but here we don't know. So for those tau, if you compute those tau in some sense, you plug into the Kalman-Mankiewicz formula, computing symbols and then computing those functionals. And the fact is that those poles are you have, you know, you could have, you might have, you know, double poles, triple poles, but it cannot exist the dimension of M plus dimension of G. So there's a upper bound for the tau K, and I don't know in general if you can reduce this number or not. And next, basically these tiles are depending on the symbol, on a transverse symbol. So you can, in principle, they can be computed and therefore, I mean, in the Kalman's curvature formula, first you have discrete dimension spectrum, so this formula can be used. Second, in general, you have all those infinite many taus, and each tau could be, you know, something you cannot compute, and so it could, in general, you could have infinite many infinities. And in the Kalman-Mankiewicz paper, they gave the strategy how to renormalize those things, infinite many infinities. But here we found this in this example, you don't have to, we have finite sum, so finite sum, and each one is decided by symbol, so it's renormalization is not needed in this case. Of course, the idea of renormalization is analog to the renormalizing in physics. Okay, so I think I finished. Had some, you know, just in case you want to see the formula in the appendix. Thank you.
Questions or comments? I think we said that the dimension spectrum rational, do you know for certain that it doesn't have to be integer? Do you know
I just said some general thing. It's just I know for sure, depending on the action, it's very easy to give you an example. It's a fraction. But I cannot give you like example. For example, this tau, this biggest non-vanishing tau is, this k, non-vanishing k is what. So, and it's basically depending on the action. So you have like five-fold action, you probably get 5/1/5. But to get this k, you know, it's like the log grows. It's like you have many repeated it's like there's a matrix. You write invariant factors, and it happens when you have repeated invariant factors. So what I showed here is very general, so I didn't even use the fact that my phase function is a very special one. And the to show this property, I actually used it in the real analytic. So this is what we know from just the fact that the phase function is real analytic. So this number could be small. The tau could be